Okay, I think we might begin. And I think the best way is that we'll take it one on one side, then the other on the other, and Dom, Steve, if you just select whoever's arm is up, and then Miles, then you select from there, and then I can just sit down and enjoy the rest. Okay, thanks.
Listening this morning, it seemed that there may be a great deal of commonality but also a point of difference in the importance that from the Buddhist perspective meditation has and from the Christian perspective that of prayer. I'd welcome both observations from both as to the essential nature for the Buddhist of meditation and the essential nature of prayer for the Christian.
Well, maybe I'll just speak very quickly that meditation is a central part of Buddhism. The Buddha became enlightened by meditating under a tree, and that was always the central part of the practice of a Buddhist, to meditate. Not all Buddhists do meditate, but that's always recognized as the essence of the path leading to enlightenment, leading to that knowledge. So a training, a way of understanding, a way of finding inner peace, and also getting that ethical and spiritual strength to your life. So yeah, meditation is very, very central to Buddhism. It is the central thing.
Meditation has a lot of different meanings to Christians. And generally, most Christians would say meditation is prayer and prayer is meditation. And generally, I think they're probably right. In a more technical sense, I would say meditation is really a preparation for prayer. It's what moves you to desire God, or what moves you to stimulate your desire for union with God. When the union with God comes about, you stop meditating. So in classical Christian literature, you would be meditating on a topic, say Jesus on the cross, and you'd be thinking about that and letting your emotions be moved by that. I would say when your emotions stop moving, when you stop thinking, you're one with God. That's the prayer. The meditation was preparation for that. You know, I go to the coast to see a sunset. That's a deliberate action designed to set me up for a moment of union. When the sunset actually hits me, I'm not thinking about going to the coast to see a sunset. I'm there. So I would personally define prayer as the bit that starts when the meditation stops. That's a highly personal answer, though.
I would just like to ask Ajahn Brahm if you could explain a little bit about the concept or theory of karma in reincarnation in Buddhist tradition.
It's a simple theory about when a person dies. The stream of consciousness. We don't call it a soul. It's a subtle difference there. And it's an important difference, but that's another question. Leaves the body and goes seeks another birth. And in the Buddhist cosmology of heaven realms, even hell realms, animal realms as well, of being a stream of consciousness entering any of those realms and being reborn again and living another life, another place. But there is a connection there. Similar to Plato's Republic of the River Lethe and flowing up, going over there into this Elysian fields. Sorry, from the Elysian fields over the River of Forgetfulness back into a new life. So there's a forgetfulness happens with many people when they get reborn again. But not all people, and some people do remember their past lives. So one of the ways of meditation is actually to recall those past experiences, not to believe it just because it says so in the books, but to find out for yourself the truth of that. So it gives you like a long journey, you know, through life of many, many lives, many places. It's not that different, as far as I understand, you know, from a Christian ideal, instead of one life and then up into a heaven realm or union with God or whatever, of many, many lives of growth. Yes, there is the end. The end is the nirvana. Well, there is actually this There's one way of explaining it, which it's almost like another need anymore. There's a simile which I wrote in that little book of the five children playing a wishing game. And the first child, the wishing game goes like this. If you had a wish, what would it be? And the first child said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for an ice cream, because it's a hot day. The second child said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for an ice cream factory, because then I could have many ice creams. So he was up in front there. The third child said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for $1 billion. US, not Australian. Because with $1 billion, I could buy my own ice cream factory. I can also buy my own video game store. When I'm at it, I buy my own school, so I don't need to go. I get the results anyway. And when I think of something else I want, I'll buy that, because with $1 billion, I could buy whatever I want. Whenever I want it, that's enough to last my lifetime. So again, the third child was winning. They asked the fourth child. And the fourth child was very smart. He said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for 3 wishes. That's a wish. For my first wish, I'll have the ice cream factory. For my second wish, I'll have $1 billion US. For my third wish, I'll have 3 more wishes. That way I can go on forever. And people thought, how can you beat, you know, the fourth child, an ultimate number of wishes? There's one more child left. The last child won the wishing game. He said, I wish, if I had one wish, I wish I was so content I never needed any more wishes. Now that's enlightenment. The end of all wishes, ultimate contentment. And that's a nice little story there which leads one on to actually understanding what the Buddhist idea of enlightenment is. What the Buddha said is the end of craving. Okay.
My question's about the historical basis of your beliefs and faith. If, hypothetically, it was shown that Jesus or Buddha never really existed or was not really the person you believe him to be, what effect would that have on your faith? Would it be devastating, or would you be able to go on believing in the essential stories of the faith?
For me, the latter.
Yeah, me too. Just like, you know, if you find out that the great book which you just read, that the author just got it from somewhere else. I don't care where it came from, as long as it's good teachings. So if it's great teachings, then it makes sense and it works. You know, the author is unimportant to me.
Abbott, sir, I've got a question for both of you about the concept of being a reader of souls, like St. John Vianney, the curé at Arc. People with intuitive insights into the deepest depths of a person's psyche, and these insights can be used to bringing healing of the memories to them. And this gift is seen within Christian circles as being a spiritual gift. Now, can either of you give us any pointers how through your respective contemplative traditions one can develop receptiveness to that gift?
Well, this is actually part of the Buddhist meditation tradition. The meditation, but just to clarify, the Buddhist meditation, I think, is equivalent to what Abbot Placid said was as prayer, because in meditation we don't think, we don't contemplate, we make the mind absolute still, beyond all thoughts. So you know, nothing moves at all in those states. And because nothing moves, you're not interfering with the signals you receive from other people. So there you can actually pick up what other people are doing and thinking. It's one of the results of deep meditation, a powerful mind which can actually feel another person. But that is not so much a gift in Buddhism, but something you can train towards. You can actually build up a spiritual power. But it's something which you don't use very lightly, because I always compare it to reading other people's mail. It's getting into their private parts, and it's not really a good thing to do. But really, you don't need to do that. Anyone who's sensitive, who is mindful, who really listens, you can pick up straight away what another person is where they are, just from their body language, just from not so much what they say, but how they say it. And if a person learns how to listen, what I sometimes call total listening, which is where you don't think or you don't second guess what the other person is trying to say. You make your mind so still and so peaceful, the inner commentary is subsided, and you just allow everything to soak in. And then you know intuitively. It's not really intuitively, you've got all the message then, and you can work out what they really mean to say, where they're coming from. You're not listening to the words, you're listening to the person. So that is usually happens with the development of the spiritual life. When you get a strong mind for many, many hours of prayer, or what Buddhism called the deep meditation, the deep stillnesses of the mind, your mind gets a lot of power. The way we describe this in Buddhism is the mind has two parts to it. You've got the, just to make it quite simple to understand, it's got an active part, which I call the doer. This is what thinks, what manages, what reacts. And the other part is a passive mind, which we call the knower. It just observes, it receives all the information. And both parts share the same source of energy. For most people, the energy is used up in too much thinking, in too much doing, too much reacting. And it means the other part of the mind, the knowing part of the mind, becomes very, very weak. As one meditates more and lives a life of stillness, you don't do so much. You don't think so much. And the energy starts flowing into the passive part of the mind, the knower. This is where you get stillness. And the stillness builds up energy of the mind until it becomes incredibly strong and ecstatic as well. The ecstasies of the Middle Age saints, one can understand where that comes from. Just the power of the mind which resides in stillness for long periods of time. And just like people like St. John of the Cross or St. Teresa of Avila or some of the Buddhist saints, they can develop such psychic powers as St. Teresa of Avila levitating. So that happens too with Buddhist meditators. Not only that, but the power to read other people's minds. That all comes from just empowering the mind through stillness. Yeah.
Thanks, yes, I think I'd agree with that. I'm a bit suspicious of Christians who are over-interested in those special psychic powers that some of the saints have had. I think it's dangerous if you set out to cultivate extraordinary powers. There's probably an element of pride and selfishness, possessiveness in that. If they happen to you, then there are a couple of criteria that I would judge by whether they're safe and reliable or not. One is whether you leave the judgment to somebody else. If you assert that your insights are divinely inspired, I wouldn't take too much notice of you. If your neighbour tells me that he thinks your insights are divinely inspired, I would take a bit more notice. And then by their fruits you shall know them. If they're charitable and humble people, yes, I think it's likely to be divinely inspired power. If they're not humble, or they're not charitable, they're not loving people, then in traditional Christian terms, this is of the devil. Not that I believe in an all-powerful devil either, but there is this matter of discernment of spirits in the Christian tradition, which is pretty important. John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila would both say, if it happens to you, then don't take any notice of it.
Do you mind living with all men?
Yeah, I'll have first go at this one. The question is, do we mind living with all men? And the answer is, yes, we do mind living with all men. I keep trying to encourage more women in the monastery, but some of the brethren are a bit suspicious of them. I think it doesn't matter too much who you live with, provided you know who you are and what you want, and provided you have contact with the other sex, the other gender. So fortunately here, we're a fairly open monastery, we have lots of visitors, and at least half of them are female. And we also have females working with us and for us on the staff and so on. So I think we're able to live a fairly balanced life. I think monks who live in an all-male monastery and never go outside and never have dealings with women, they're in a fairly dangerous situation. They can get pretty unbalanced. But then I think the same is true of women who live in convents and don't have touch with men in their life. It's not impossible that they are very healthy people, but mingling with the other sex, I think, is pretty important for human sanity.
So when I first went to Thailand and learnt the Thai language, I found in the Thai language there's actually three genders. There's males, there's females, and there's monks. It's as if we're put aside. The monks also include nuns there. The monastics, the ones who renounce the, sort of the genders. And it's true that we do have our nuns' monastery, which is in Kijiganup. And if you see those nuns and you see the monks, sometimes you can't tell the difference. We made sure the nuns were a darker shade of brown, and we keep the lighter shade of brown just so we know who's who. And it's helpful when you have toilets, like Don Chris was saying. But that's the only difference there. But I do agree that it's very important for monks not to be too cloistered, that they do get out into the world every now and again to actually go out. We have our little city centre in Olamara where we take the monks out to where we teach. We meet other people there. And it's also important, and one of the reasons I like bringing my monks here, it's important that the Buddhists actually meet other religions as well. And so it's not just living with other men. Please don't live with other Catholics. Remember, Buddhists, there's a few Buddhists here. Don't just live with other Buddhists either. That's one of the problems when Muslims live with other Muslims. That's one of the big problems of our world.
Got one here. Both of you as younger men seem to have gone through fairly significant conversions to Buddhism and to Catholicism. What conversions are happening in your lives right now?
I wouldn't say conversions, I saw convergence. Even like the idea of conversion, because there's never a sense that there's one moment in your life you sort of flip over from one thing to another. There's a gradual leaning towards one particular path, as if, you know, that I took the path of Buddhism and Abbot Placid took the path of Christianity, first in Anglicanism, then in Catholicism. But we sort of went on these paths, which were separate. But as we sort of come together at this age of our lives, we're coming much closer together. So are we really different that we can say that we change from one thing to another thing? Or is it just, you know, the colour of our robes are different, but our blood is the same colour red? And I think that's more likely the truth. I don't think I would like to talk about conversions now. I'd like to talk about convergence. I don't know if that's...
Well, I guess I was talking also about learning and growing and change, which has been part of your dialogue today. Not talking about difference, really.
And indeed, that, again, like listening and always open to change, always open to seeing new things. I think that is also very true, that when one is stuck, one thinks one knows everything, and there's a bit of a death there which happens, a spiritual death. And even if you have an core understanding of what you think is truth, still the ways to express it, the ways to talk about it will always be changing. And there's always a deepening of your understanding and the way that you relate to others. And that's always the growth. And I think people who think they have all the answers, they're dead. They're just like an old tree which has got no sap growing through it again. Maybe change is that sap which keeps the leaves going ever greener.
To study theology, I was sent to Fribourg in Switzerland, where we lived in a seminary for students for the priesthood in the Swiss Catholic cantons, and went to the university every day and did a lot of reading and listening, talking with the brethren a lot, discussing. And I got into the habit there of asking myself before I went to sleep every night, what's new today? What have I picked up today? There was never a day when I hadn't picked something up. And I haven't kept up that practice of asking myself every day, but when I do, and I do occasionally, there's never short of anything that I haven't learned, that I haven't changed. Somebody or something, something I've read or something that's happened has changed me. And I can be grateful for that.
Yes, I'd like to go back to what Abbot Placid said earlier on. I could be wrong. I think I've been enlightened this afternoon, and I could be wrong. So I want you to enlighten, to let me know. Because I was under, I've always been a Christian, a Catholic, but I have Buddhist friends, and I've always felt this much difference, really, every time I hear my Buddhist friends talking. And then there was only one thing that I could see as a difference, and I can think now it was grossly simplistic on my part to think that, because I thought that Christians believed in God and Buddhists didn't. Now this afternoon I hear you two talking about this notion of God, and to me, you don't differ at all in this notion of trying to put a figure on this venerable old man with a beard up there in the clouds or whatever. And am I wrong in being thinking I've been enlightened here and reassured that you're actually, both of you believe in the same
thing? You all heard the question okay at the back? No, not quite. The lady has been impressed by how much Ajahn Brahm and I seem to be able to speak the same language about God. And she's delighted to find that it's not true that Christians believe in God and Buddhists don't. The truth goes much deeper than that, that we are really talking about the same thing, no matter what language we're using. Is she wrong in this perception? And she thinks it's a good thing that this is the case. Is she wrong about that? Well, I would say no, she's right about both. I think the ultimate reality that anybody is dealing with in any religion has to be the same. There can only be one infinitely satisfying reality, being. Whether you call it God, whether you call it Nirvana, it doesn't matter what you call it. We're all talking about the same thing. And it's more important than any of the other things we talk about, some of which are extremely important, but nowhere near. All the other things are finite. This one's infinite. You have a shot.
Not about talking about the same things. I think we talk too much. And it's what we do is more important. And I don't look to see what you're talking about or what Abbot Placid is talking about, but I always look at what he does. And that's where we really come together. And there's something we've been talking about here. We've been moving. What you think is, we said different words, so we come from different angles, but you can see there's something commonly we're doing here. And I think that's what brings us together. That's what you're recognizing. The Buddhists might talk in a different language and say different things. The Catholics will talk in a different language and do different things. But what actually we do in our life, and how do we relate to one another? I think what's between us, I think that's again what I like to focus on. What's between us is the same. You know, you're a different person than I am, but what's between us is what draws us together. It's actually what's between us, the space between us in this room. It's not what separates us, but what joins us together. I remember when I was in Singapore, they were having a conference, and they went to a press release where we poured some water, some holy water, into the straits between Singapore and Indonesia to spread to all the different parts of the world, so like spreading the word of this great conference we were going to hold in Singapore.
And the media were there and they said, "No, what are you doing this for?" And I said, "Because these waters here, these oceans, they're not what separates the different countries, but it's what actually connects the countries." And I think it's that's between us, is what connects us and what separates us. And that's actually how I like to look between myself and Albert Placid, between Buddhists and Christians. What's between us is what connects us, not separates us.